Happy President's Day. This is the takeaway for Monday, February 19th, 2018.
Over the last several days, this country yet again is grappling with the reality and aftermath of a mass shooting. And the question of who and what is to blame. For millions of Americans, the answer lies in gun control. For others, it's about addressing America's mental health problem.
We have a lot of mental health problems in our country.
There's some pretty sick kids out there, and I think we got to do a better job of mental health.
This isn't a guns situation.
It seems like one common denominator is mental illness.
There's mental health and addiction issues.
We don't know right now exactly why this deranged individual did this.
People with mental illness are getting guns and conducting these mass shootings.
We've got to find out some way of getting those people into the FBI database so that they aren't able to buy guns.
By the way, we need to significantly improve mental health services.
I think that mental health is your problem here.
Today, we fact-check the claims that connect mental health illnesses to gun violence. Are mentally ill people more likely to commit violence? Is it fair to say they should be banned from having guns? Should mental health really be the focus after a shooting like we saw in Parkland, Florida? I'm Tanzina Vega, and today we unpack these questions on The Takeaway. With us today is Jonathan Metzl. He's director of Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, and research director of the Safe Tennessee Project. Jonathan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we have a ton of things to unpack here, and I'm particularly interested in this narrative around mental health. I think this is one of the times that we, or one of the many times we hear about this, but this shooting seems to have brought this to the forefront. Is mental health, has mental illness or mental health, if you will, become a scapegoat to larger issues facing this country when it comes to firearms?
Well, it's a great way to start this conversation. And first, let me say just empathically, as somebody who studies this issue and also trained in mental health, that it's understandable to me why, as a society, we turn to questions of mental illness and mental health in the aftermath of these shootings. These shootings are unbelievably traumatizing. We try to divide a line between our own civilized society and somebody who would act with such disregard for human life. And of course, there are significant psychological histories for many of these high-profile mass shooters. And so in that regard, that turn is understandable as a national way of processing the trauma that we've experienced. But at the same time, people like myself who study this find it highly, highly irresponsible and really almost an abdication of leadership to just focus on mental illness from the top down for, I think, three main reasons. One is that, as we see in the Florida shooting, there are so many factors that might lead somebody who has a troubled history to commit an act like this. A second is that I can say as a psychiatrist, unfortunately, there's no psychiatric diagnosis whose symptom is shooting somebody else or harming somebody else. And I would challenge the leaders who are saying this is a mental health issue to tell us what is the diagnosis here. In a way, it's a concert of many factors, but it's not like somebody with depression or schizophrenia has one of their symptoms to go shoot somebody. And so in that regard, it's not like there's a predictive value of psychiatric diagnosis. And I think that's really a key issue, that it's multifactorial. And then I think the last part is, if you just look at the statistics of gun violence across the United States, people with mental illness are across the board more likely to be victims of crimes and even of shootings many times than are sane people in a particular way. And so in a way, what we're doing is we're playing an old stereotype and we're flipping it in order to give an easy answer that I feel like is not going to be effective.
I also wonder a little bit about the narratives that we have in this country, where we talk a lot about individual responsibility, right? And there were lots of calls at this after this shooting for individuals to have reported suspicious behavior to police. And in this case, the FBI had been warned about the shooter and admitted to failing to follow up. And the mental illness focus also seems to be very much on individual behavior versus sort of societal and collective issues.
Right.
What can we do to sort of change that?
it's so complicated, right? Because there were also people who were highly trained in seeing these kind of cases who were probably seeing thousands and thousands of cases in that regard. And so in that sense, there was no exact test. And it's important to also remember that those visits were happening in the context of a state where it's unbelievably easy for people 18 years and older to get semi-automatic rifles. And so to individuate this question in a way takes it out of the broader context of what I think people are pushing back on now, which is, yes, there are individual issues. And there are things that individuals can do. Many states have something called a gun violence restraining order, because I think the idea is basically people's families, their intimate partners, people like that, are good at predicting when somebody is going to escalate. So there are policies that some states try that look at that individual question. But again, the problem with it is when you take it out of the context of a bigger issue of just having so many guns around and having it be so easy, that in a way it puts an unnecessary onus on people whose job it is to keep us safe.
And speaking of people whose job it is to keep us safe, I'm wondering how prepared law enforcement is to really deal with this issue of mental health. It seems like we're just tossing around a term, but I mean, as you know, the way that we tend to deal with mental illness largely in this country has often been through criminality, right? It's often our jails have become our mental health providers. So are they prepared to deal with this? And if this is really such an issue, what does law enforcement have to do to improve?
Well, certainly I agree that we need more investment in our mental health system across the board. And I also agree that there are issues of incarcerating basically people with serious mental illness. Prisons become de facto mental health facilities. All of that is absolutely true. And at the same time, I feel like, getting back to what we were talking about before, where is mental health expertise useful? It's useful in prevention, not in prediction. In other words, there's no psychiatrist who's going to sit down, or a law enforcement officer who's going to say, this one person out of the thousands that I see is going to go on to commit this act. We're nearing 40,000 gun deaths a year in this country. We are far and away number one in that regard. Also, most mass shootings don't make it to the news. Most mass shootings happen in areas where they're not quite as spectacular. They're not what's called white-on-white crime. And so in a way, what we're seeing is a small symptom, a very important one, of a bigger issue. And so I feel like, again, this gets back to the question of mental illness when people say, oh, it's just in one person's mind, there's nothing we can do about it. But I really feel like if we look at the broad patterns of gun violence in the United States, we know that there are a constellation of factors that respect people's gun rights on one hand, but will limit the trends that we're seeing. And I think really look at – just compare states that have tight gun laws versus ones that don't, and it kind of is self-explanatory.
You mentioned white-on-white crime, and I want to talk a little bit about the racially tinged labels that we often see around these mass shootings, particularly lone wolf, when the shooter is, say, white male. What impact does that have?
Right. Well, so I wrote a piece for the Washington Post a couple of months ago called When the Shooter is White, after the Las Vegas shooting. And it kind of addressed that same point, which is that there's a racial narrative that we tell. And just to summarize it, basically, when the shooter is white, it's often a lone, troubled individual or an individual mind. But when the shooter is a black or brown person, the story we tell is it's a pathological culture. So it links to this bigger ideology of sick black culture or terrorism, other factors. And so there are these different ways that we narrate mass shootings. Is it somebody's individual mind, or is it a cultural reflection? And in the piece, I kind of reflect on that and basically say that those two narratives lead to very different cultural responses.
And it also could potentially impact who and how folks who are mentally ill are treated if they are seen as a danger to themselves or to larger society. Jonathan, this is a very complicated issue, and thank you so much for being with us to talk about it.
Thanks so much. It was my honor.
Jonathan Metzl is director of Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, and research director of the Safe Tennessee Project.
Eu te peço a ti, Pai, no nome de Jesus, que venha levantar avivamento. Aonde que a tua presença?
That is a Brazilian prayer service for the victims of the Parkland shooting. Parkland has a population of approximately 31,000 residents, and among those, about 20% of people are foreign-born, with some who fled countries racked by violence. But even among this population, Wednesday's horror was unimaginable. Kayvon Antonio Hadari is a reporter with Reporters Without Borders covering the Caribbean and Florida.
Parkland is an enclave which has very high education levels, and a lot of people have come from other countries such as Germany, Mexico, a lot from Brazil, and other places where they found that in Parkland gave them a sort of a refuge of a sense of protection in a small community where it seems that they had everything all in an enclave, that they felt that they were protected. Some of the people said that before, a car break-in was sort of like a big deal. Now, this is a new reality.
And I'm wondering if before moving here, were any of the families you spoke to aware of other school shootings, including Columbine or Sandy Hook?
Some of them were. But, of course, kids don't have the historical background to be able to process that. You know, for example, a lot of them came from other places. Joaquin Oliver, who was from Venezuela, he died, and his best friend Daniel Journey was looking for him to see if there were any news of him the night of the shooting. And he had no clue of the history of school shootings in the United States.
I honestly didn't know about that. I don't watch the news a lot because it makes, you know, I don't like looking at bad things. It makes me sad. But now thinking back, I probably should watch the news because something newsworthy happened to me today. And I hope people are watching me so I can give out the word to, you know, be safe.
Kayvon, I'm wondering if the families you spoke to, you mentioned earlier, they came here and they felt sort of protected by the enclave that they lived in, the community they lived in. But was it bigger than just the community? Was it coming to the United States and expecting something very different than what they've encountered in terms of their general safety?
I think you're right. For example, there's a lot of Brazilians that come from cities like Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, where sort of violence is sort of is a constant menace. Street violence, maybe petty street crime, and they tend to stay together, stick together with the people they know and the situations they know. It's sort of, imagine you're driving in a city where perhaps every intersection could be dangerous, and as opposed to driving in the interstate and all of a sudden a car comes down going in the wrong direction and you don't expect it. And I sense that this one for them is that interstate with the car coming and going in the wrong direction and all of a sudden getting hammered by this event.
Are any of these families that you spoke to deciding to take more extreme measures and just move out of the United States, where this issue isn't such a daily or weekly or monthly occurrence?
I don't know about that. I haven't heard anybody that is thinking of uprooting themselves and finding a new place. Of course, they came here, set down roots, and I guess some will determine what they want to do in this situation. But I have a feeling that they feel that after this, you know, it's tough to be scared of anything. These kids have been shot at. What are they going to be scared of? Politics and anything else? The families, that's a different story. I don't know, but I presume some of them might be thinking of or have the means to have a second home in another place.
Kayvon, thank you for being with us today on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Kayvon Antonio Hadari is a reporter with Reporters Without Borders covering the Caribbean and Florida. Welcome back to The Takeaway on this busy President's Day. I'm Tanzina Vega with you for the hour. Last year, President Trump issued an executive order that, among other things, expanded the reach of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, allowing the agency to arrest new categories of undocumented immigrants. Under those guidelines, ICE arrested almost 144,000 people last year, a three-year high. The biggest increase in arrests were in the Miami, Dallas, and St. Paul regions. But while arrests are up, deportations are actually down, a total of 6% from last year. What's this discrepancy all about and who's caught in the middle? For some answers, we turn to Jackie Stevens, a professor and director of Northwestern University's Deportation Research Clinic. Jackie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about what's really happening on the ground. You say arrests are going up, but deportations are actually down?
Oh, that's right. I mean, as a percentage, the deportations are down because people who have viable claims for remaining in the United States are correctly going to immigration court and trying to overcome the conditions of detention in order to show the merits of their case in an immigration court.
So we saw that, I think there was a Washington Post piece a couple of days ago that said that President Trump had basically taken the shackles off of ICE. Can you explain what that means about, and specifically how it's connected to these arrests?
Right. Well, ICE itself is bragging about how it's making these what they call arrests at large. And what that means is that they're going into communities where there may be an expectation that there are a higher percentage of people who are immigrants. And they're just, you know, brazenly asking people for their identification. If the identification documents aren't there, or if there's some kind of, you know, ping with a database, then they'll just arrest them on the spot and bring them in. ICE is also bragging that about 80% of the people they're arresting now are being detained. And what we've seen under the Trump administration is just an enormous uptick in the percentages of people who are being brought into these, you know, really gruesome detention facilities.
You know, in the previous administration, President Obama was called, you know, the deporter in chief, right, by a lot of immigrant activists for the way that his administration was going after certain immigrants. What's different from what the Obama administration approach to this was to the Trump administration approach?
Okay. So the first term of Obama's administration, you know, hundreds of thousands of people each year were detained and deported under the Obama administration. In the second term, those numbers went down quite substantially. And this is after, you know, he implemented prosecutorial discretion. So, for instance, in 2015, there were 96,000 people detained by ICE. And in 2016, there were 86,000 people detained by ICE. However, in 2017, under the Trump administration, they issued 142,000 detainers. So you can see that there's been, you know, quite an uptick. You know, many of those people have no criminal history and would otherwise not have been snagged under the protocols that Obama had in place.
Which, just to be clear, the Obama administration was really focusing more on those who had a criminal history. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was actually in immigration court in Chicago with my students a few weeks ago, and we saw a case of somebody who was from Glenview, Illinois, and was in a district of a Democrat, Jan Schakowsky, and he was in there because the ICE agents were just staking out this housing complex that happened to be associated with having a lot of Latinos living there. The ICE agents were just following people around and asking for their identification, and this individual actually happened to have been arrested and convicted for a misdemeanor battery in 2011. So under the Obama administration, he, you know, dealt with the criminal violation and was released. But it's the same person in the same arrest that now has triggered him being brought into detention. And, you know, he ended up actually being released on bond after being held for a few months. The immigration judge thought that there were merits to his case and he likely will not be deported. But he had an attorney. He had a strong family network that was able to show up in immigration court and speak on his behalf. And, you know, a lot of people who don't have those kinds of resources are going to find themselves in a different situation.
So two questions I want to ask you on that. What's the cost on that, first of all, of these detentions? Because we know that incarcerating folks or detaining people comes at a cost to us, doesn't it?
That's absolutely correct. So the average, you know, cost per day of holding somebody in those kinds of conditions is about $120. And, you know, the alternatives to that are ankle monitoring or just releasing people on their own recognizance, and, you know, which is done every day in the context of criminal proceedings that don't have the kinds of, you know, consequences that deportation proceedings do.
Is there anybody making money off of this?
So, yes. I mean, you know, obviously the prison industry is making huge amounts of money off of this, and they've, you know, bragged about the profits that they get. There's a bit of a revolving door between the people who are in ICE and the people who are, you know, running those industries, a lot of lobbying. And again, although there are those kinds of economic incentives for that one industry, there are other industries that are being hurt really badly by these kinds of policies, and those concerns aren't actually being taken into account by the administration.
I mean, in some ways, I know the United States has a very spotty track record with immigration, but I'm wondering how much the current narrative that's coming out of the administration, the MS-13, the criminals who are coming to get you, how much has that narrative that comes out from the administration really sort of increase public support for this type of for these arrests and detentions?
Well, it looks like it has, but that's always been the case, right? Like, there's always been this effort to associate immigrants with criminality on the part of those who don't want immigrants in the United States. Interestingly enough, even though the Trump administration is pushing this line and emphasizing data that have to do with arrests of people who have been convicted of drunk driving or of traffic violations, it turns out that 80,000 people that they've targeted who were arrested for drunk driving are less than 0.5% of all of the people who were arrested in 2017 for drunk driving, which is like 1.5 million people. And that's just for 1 year. So when you think about, 80,000 people who are being deported because of their drunk driving convictions that may go back decades, it's not really doing much to increase our safety. There's two things that are going on. One, obviously, Trump ran on a platform of wanting to deport people, and there is a minority of people in this country who strongly support that, but strong and persistent majorities of people oppose a number of the policies that he's pursuing. And I think what we're going to have to watch is what happens in upcoming elections to see, if people are going to the polls and will vote to reject those practices.
Jackie Stevens, thanks so much for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Jackie Stevens is a professor and director of Northwestern University's Deportation Research Clinic. And now, a takeaway on the tangible effects of climate change.
I was in the cellar when the water came rushing in. It was scary.
The whole street was flooded. There was a dumpster that floated out of the alley. I know everybody saw that video. And then there was trash barrels floating down Farnsworth Street, and the whole thing was just in a matter of seconds underwater.
Residents of Boston there remembering the frightening flooding caused by last month's powerful nor'easter, or what meteorologists were calling the bomb cyclone. Yet despite the warnings we hear from scientists that a warming planet is causing real change like rising waters, the storm's extreme flooding still surprised some people. But climate change expert George Marshall isn't shocked at all that people don't take the risks of climate change more seriously.
There was a set of very famous psychology experiments done back in the 1950s where people were sitting in rooms with smoke coming under the door, and they'd look around and nobody else in the room was doing anything. And they didn't do anything.
In other words,
people take their cues for what they think is important or dangerous or real, primarily from the people around them, more even than the things that they're directly experiencing.
Marshall is the author of Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. He talked with Arun Rath, correspondent of our partner WGBH in Boston, who has been investigating this phenomenon of why we have trouble accepting the tangible effects of climate change.
Climate change has very much become a topic of the left. If you think of the real evangelist of climate change action, that's Al Gore.
We must reverse the silent rising tide of global warming.
Which might be fine as a messenger for you if you're a liberal Democrat, but if you're a conservative, that's sort of a hard person to take on. And if it becomes divided like that and you're in with your peer group thinking this particular way, it's really hard to break out of that thinking.
George, you've witnessed, you've been to the United States to New Jersey on the coast after Hurricane Sandy. What type of reactions did you see when you visited?
I asked people up and down the coast about their experiences of Hurricane Sandy, and the stories that they would tell would be ones of community pride, of a sense of a intense pride, a sense of shared humanity, but people had really come together so strongly around this event, supported each other. And then I asked them, tell me about the last conversation you had with your neighbors and friends about climate change. And nobody could recall for me a single conversation that they'd had. It was clear that what was going on there was not just simply that people weren't talking about it, but they were actively suppressing it. Because it seems to me pretty obvious that if something has happened to you that scientists have been warning for the last 20 years is going to happen, you'd think that it might come up somewhere in the conversation. I have to say, I did a range of research in other places too in the States that had extreme weather events, and the same thing happened again and again. And I think what happens is that people go into a recovery mode. Something traumatic happens to them. They all come together, and they are concentrated on working together in a very cooperative way towards recovery. The last thing anybody wants to talk about is any reason for thinking this might happen again. And climate change, as we know, is deeply divisive. So people said to me, they said, why am I going to talk about climate change? I'm really now, for the first time, really close to my Republican next door neighbor. I'm not going to start talking to them about climate change. So you have a divisive issue and you have a time when people have really come together. They're going to concentrate on that togetherness and not on the divisiveness.
Arun, you cover neuroscience for WGBH. What struck you about how our brains are not exactly quite up to the job when it comes to facing up to climate change?
A funny thing hit me as I was talking to experts like George about this. I've been doing reporting recently on adolescent brain development and what it can tell us about how teenagers make decisions. Behavioral scientists talk about these two decision-making systems. System one, which tends to be our impulsive decisions. They're driven by emotion and immediate context. You know, we might think of our gut decisions. And now that's good when it has you jump out of the way of a speeding car, but it's bad if, say, you do something in anger or irrational like that. Then there's system two, which is the more sophisticated long-term thinking that involves planning and considering consequences, like, say, planning for climate change consequences.
That your house might be flooded or that it might just be destroyed entirely.
Exactly. And because of where their brains are with development, it turns out that adolescents, system one often takes priority over system two because system two, the sophisticated part, the long-range planning part, doesn't kick in as fast. What I learned more recently regarding denial and climate change and talking to people like George is that it seems like when humans are acting in groups when it comes to climate change, we tend to act like adolescents.
This is not a hopeless situation at all. We just need to recognize that this is challenging for us, not impossible.
So we can rewire our brains? Is that what you're saying?
No, we don't rewire at all. We recognize this is the way that we are and that this has actually done very well for us, but we work with it. And I think the way we do that is we recognize that our primary motivations and our primary guidance comes from the people around us and comes in the form of narrative, of stories, of metaphor, and of things which really speak to us and our values. So I think that what we do is we start rebuilding the way we talk about climate change as something which is shared between people in their own values. So that's to say, rather than having a single thing, scientists say this to us, we must do something. We have a Republican narrative on it, and we have an evangelical narrative, and we have a liberal narrative. And each different group of people speak about it in terms of their own values with each other. So we have to have a thing where my recommendation for places that have been hit by extreme weather, for example, is that they start talking within the community saying, hey, we're really strong. We're really proud of how we came through with that. Now let's start talking about how we're going to build on that community cohesion and work towards the future and the reality which is happening. So a different kind of conversation which is led by locally driven, values-driven narratives, speaking to very different people in different ways. And that we know will speak to the way that our brains work.
Can the media have any influence on that? I know where everyone loves us these days, so just checking.
Well, I'll tell you one thing the media can stop doing is playing this as if it's some kind of debate. Constantly what we have is this idea that there is a debate going out there and therefore the media have to be balanced and they have to have someone saying climate change is a problem and someone saying it's a myth. We definitely need to move on from that. But the media also has to have different voices, you know, like, please stop talking about this as an environmental issue. It isn't. It's an issue that affects every aspect of our lives. So don't get some guy on from an environmental campaign group. Get somebody on who speaks to a different set of values and a different set of concerns. And we need a much, much wider range of voices on this, particularly people from the right.
Arun, George, thank you for being with us today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
George Marshall is co-founder of Climate Outreach, and Arun Rath is correspondent with our partner, WGBH in Boston.
We're losing an average of 1,000 Oklahomans a year to overdoses, and the great majority of those overdoses are attributable to opioids.
That's Attorney General Mike Hunter there, talking about a crisis that has hit every state in America. Oklahoma will be the first state in the country to go to trial against an opioid manufacturer.
When companies create this conspiracy of misinformation and pseudoscience, and the result is that they are creating a generation or generations of addicts, and that they are in effect causing the deaths of people in our state, they need to be held accountable.
Oklahoma is one of a number of states that have filed lawsuits against opioid manufacturers alleging misleading marketing. But it's the only state to see its suit move ahead, with a trial date set for 2019. I asked Attorney General Mike Hunter why he went down this road in the first place.
Companies who are defendants in this lawsuit have systematically over the last couple of decades defrauded prescribers, misrepresented the addictive qualities of opioids, and they did so by setting up entities that looked bona fide but were really just issuing propaganda and loaded studies, quote, end quote, studies, to try to convince prescribers that opioids were not addictive. And the goal there was to fill the space that the medical community had created by determining that they wanted pain to be one of the new vital signs that physicians need to treat. So companies saw an opening, and the opening was, let's convince prescribers that if we have a time-release element that we build into these drugs, that they're not addictive. Well, nothing could be further from the truth.
I'm curious, are you looking at this for sort of economic paybacks in some way for the all of the money that you're saying that was spent on law enforcement and I'm sure on public health issues? What's the end goal with this? I mean, why spend money going after this company?
At the end of this process, at the end of suing these people, we want that judgment to be set aside and dedicated to getting the people of the state who have suffered, who are dealing with addiction, getting them well, and use the proceeds for treatment to try to get this sector of our population well.
But there have been some critiques that Oklahoma's plans don't adequately cover the opioid-addicted population. What would your response to that be?
Well, that's why we stood up the commission. I've had this job for almost a year, and it's been a focus for me. And my resolve is that with a multi-focus approach that deals with not only public policy recommendations that help us do more, holding companies accountable for their misdeeds, and making prescribers understand that they have not only a responsibility to their patients as a healer, but a responsibility to the public to not be reckless with their prescribing. Those are all things that we're doing in my office. The state and the federal government has to invest in treatment programs, but you have to start somewhere. I am committed not only to the law enforcement side of this, but I'm also committed to the treatment and rehabilitation side. And certainly the state has to do more. The federal government has to do more. I'm hopeful that this money in the latest budget bill will be deployed quickly and we can put it to use here.
Have you seen progress? Are you excited or hopeful about what you're seeing at the federal level so far?
I really believe the federal government needs to do more on the law enforcement side. The president declared the epidemic a national public health emergency. It needs to be a national emergency. When more people die in the United States each year than died in the war in Vietnam, you've got a clear and present danger. And I'm hopeful the administration will recast their determination that this is not just a public health emergency, it's a national emergency.
Thank you so much, Attorney General Hunter, for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
The youngest sufferers of the opioid crisis, newborn babies.
One of the most nightmarish consequences of all this is this past year, looks like almost 1,000 babies are born substance impacted.
That's Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter again. The National Institutes of Health have announced that they are giving $1 million toward research to determine a national treatment standard for infants born to addicted mothers. Currently, there isn't one. Instead, the national standard has been to allow infants to go into full withdrawal before treating them. But in Greenville, South Carolina, they're taking a different approach, giving babies tiny doses of methadone to wean them. Dr. Jennifer Hudson is a pediatrician and medical director for newborn services at Greenville Health System and spearheaded the new approach.
When those babies were born, the pattern that I saw very quickly was that they did well on the first day. They started to have some minor symptoms of withdrawal on the second day. And the third or fourth day, babies would enter full-blown withdrawal and really suffer.
Tell me a little bit about what's happening at the Greenville Medical Center and how is it being effective for these babies?
Sure. So we, around 2004, decided to think outside the box and really talk about whether there was a way that we could prevent babies exposed to long-acting opioids from going into withdrawal at birth. Essentially, when they're born, they quit cold turkey. They stop receiving the medication that the mother has been prescribed. So we sat down with a team of pediatric pharmacists and said, you know, is there a way to just simply continue the babies on the medication that mothers have been taking? Not to give them so much that it causes over-sedation and trouble waking up, but not to give them so little that they go into full-blown withdrawal. So we came up with a treatment regimen that we start within 24 hours of birth. Basically, while the mother's medication is working its way out of the baby's system, we're giving the baby tiny doses to land somewhere in a middle zone. And then the other component that we've added is weaning from home under the care of a pediatric practice in our local community.
So, and I'm just wondering, are there any trends that you're seeing in the mothers that are coming in terms of demographics? Are many of them low income? Are they single moms? Like what type of issues are they dealing with in addition to obviously this really terrible opioid addiction?
Most of the mothers who are having babies at risk for NAS are in treatment, but the reason for treatment does vary. Some mothers have used street drugs like heroin, but I would say a majority started with a prescription. I would say that a majority of the pregnancies that I see in mothers who are using opioids, whether they're in treatment or not, are unplanned. And that's consistent with CDC data that about 86% of mothers using opioids end up with unplanned pregnancies. Many women are single. I'm starting to see more mothers who are married and with insurance, and even who are planning their pregnancies despite the fact that they're in treatment for opioid addiction or dependence. There are usually a variety of social factors that we do have to assess and deal with. Mental health issues are a big problem in this population. Many mothers who started using opioids have a history of emotional, physical, or sexual trauma in their past. And the opioids, when taken for a pain problem or surgery, also help to blunt emotional issues or mental health issues that a mother may be experiencing. So they're particularly addictive compared to other substances.
Are you seeing a stigma that's attached to these mothers that's perhaps growing? Or is that, are we in a new phase right now where we're looking at this more as a public health issue as opposed to a personal failing?
It is true that the new focus on the opioid epidemic is helping with the stigma, but the stigma is still a huge problem. And I think that's largely why we don't see a lot of people talking about it. They're afraid of losing employment. They're afraid of losing friends. They're afraid of losing family support. And they're just afraid of being judged. So we're very careful in the healthcare setting to treat women with respect and help them regardless of their past struggles and to not insert more judgment that they've already been subjected to. It is a huge problem.
Dr. Hudson, thank you for being with us today on The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Jennifer Hudson is a pediatrician and medical director for newborn services at Greenville Health System. Hashtag Team USA So White.
This is definitely the most diverse games that we've seen, especially from the United States standpoint, but it's still 92% white.
That's Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Davis says there's a lot to think about when it comes to diversity in the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang this year.
This is a year where we are seeing the most diversity that we've ever seen. So we have 10 African-American participants, 11 Asian-American participants. We have 2 openly gay athletes. If you look to the women's bobsled team, for instance, 4 out of 5 women on the women's bobsled teams are women of color. And really credit to Alana Myers-Taylor there, who's gone out and recruited heavily to bring Black women into the sport. You also have Jordan Greenway, who's the first African-American to be on the U.S. hockey national team. And then besides from Nation Chen, you have Chloe Kim, who gold medaled in an amazing half pipe competition, and the Shibs of Alex and Maya Shibutani, and Mirai, who skates for U.S. figure skating. And so what you are seeing is an increase in diversity. But like I said, even if you add this all up, you're still left with a squad that is 92% white.
So let's unpack that a little bit. How does your squad get 92% white? Because I'm imagining it's potentially the type of sport, maybe, and also the accessibility to these sports? I mean, it's not cheap to learn how to ski, right? I mean,
precisely. And you're hitting the nail completely on the head here. Now, I know that a lot of people watch the Winter Games and be like, well, Black people don't play those games because it's cold. And, you know, and I think that there's certainly a lot of people who are like, it's too cold to be out here skiing and sledding and whatnot. But definitely this comes down to cost, to access, to proximity to training sites, right? And so a lot of these winter sports, and we can see this how historically it's been dominated by kind of white and wealthy Scandinavian nations. The United States is in there because it really does cost a lot to get to a ski site and get on the ski lift. You also have just kind of narratives of participation, which I think shapes a lot of ideas about who plays what, right? And so if you think about tracking in school, this is the same kind of instance in sports. So if you see the NFL, you see the NBA, you see track and field, and that's kind of like the narrative, like this is what Black kids play, right? This is where the sport that you belong in. And so when you take the issue of kind of lack of representation along with cost to participate in a lot of these sports, which are very expensive, and proximity to training sites, you end up with this kind of dearth of diversity in the games. And I also think that we have to understand that this is not just a United States problem. This is a global issue, right? The global South has like always been very, very underrepresented in the sport. And I think that everybody kind of throws up his hands, well, like, oh, they don't have snow, so why would they? But there's a way that especially we celebrate the Olympics as this kind of global international sporting space. And we just kind of like shrug our shoulders at the fact that, you know, we don't care that half the globe isn't represented at these games.
And is there any, I mean, you know, we like you mentioned, there is lots of diversity. There are 8% diversity on the American team this year. But and those folks are getting a lot of attention, and that's amazing. But does that actually hide the bigger issues that we're talking about, which are access? And do we have to wait another 4, 8, you know, 12 years to actually get, you know, some more change in the games?
Right. No, I think that's a great way of framing it, which is to say that lost in the celebration is the fact that there is a lot of work to be done. And, you know, Jason Thompson, who is the U.S. Committee Director on Diversity and Inclusion, has definitely acknowledged this and said, while we're listening to all the celebration, we're definitely not where we want to be. And I think one of the great things to pay attention to are the ways that you can recruit and retain in these sports. So I mentioned Elena, who is a bobsledder, who's literally just gone to people who run track and fellow Olympians and said, hey, come train with me. Come check out what bobsledding is. Come use your speed and compete for this Olympic team. And that has done wonders for diversifying the sport. And that's a really great model of seeing how easy it is, right, to recruit if you put the time and effort in. And I think that we also, the other thing about this particular squad is that they all are really, really high profile. Like, these aren't people who just barely made the team. They are gold medalists like Chloe Kim. They're in medal contention. And I think that really goes a long way about visibility. And then you have them outspoken. So there's a great quote that Jasmine Falenter Victorian, who's a Jamaican bobsledder, gave about the importance of representation. She said, little girls and little boys see someone who looks like them, talks like them, has the same culture as them, has crazy curly hair, wears a natural, has brown skin, and is doing these different things. And when you grow up and you don't see that, you feel like you can't do it and that's not right. And I think that that's a great quote to have her kind of say on this platform, to say, no, this stuff matters and we need to put in the work to continue on this path. We can't just be, you know, satisfied with, you know, I said 8% for the United States, but overall, if you take the larger numbers, you're talking about less than 2% of the entire Olympic athletes being Black, for instance.
And I'm probably going to date myself by reminding people about when I was a kid and watching Mary Lou Retton, there was no diversity that I can recall. So that was definitely something that I remember. But whose job is it to make the Olympics more diverse? Is it the Olympic Committee? Is it parents? Like, who's actually supposed to make this change?
Yeah, that is a tremendous question. And I think it's multiple people, right? So definitely, if you want to go straight to the top, the U.S. Olympic Committee obviously has a director of diversity and inclusion. So they've even kind of benchmarked as their own goal, right? So definitely it starts from the top. They need to put resources, and they have the resources and time and energy into doing this. But I think that you can draw the line all the way down, right? So if you're a high school coach, right, if you're a club team scout, if you're a collegiate coach, there's all these levels in which we can be helping to further these pipelines, especially because when you're talking about these sports, so much of this starts when you're young. And this comes back to the access issue. It's the same thing with like club soccer, for instance, swimming. A lot of these sports, you have to get into the pipeline when you're young, and you have to have those connections and have those resources at your disposal when you are a teenager, or sometimes in some sports, even younger. And so I think that it's not enough to just point at the, you know, U.S. Olympic Committee and say, this is your job alone, because it has to be, I think, all hands on deck type of approach that is beyond just the kind of Olympic Committee, and goes into even how we think about representing sport in what games we show, what after-school programs we offer to kids, and where. I know that I live out here in State College, Pennsylvania, and my daughter can get a bus and go sled and ski and snowboard directly from school. But my husband, who grew up in Philadelphia, did not have buses coming to West Philly to pick him up and take him to a slope anywhere.
No, and we don't really understand what that's like. Like, I mean, I kind of flip it, you know, said I was watching Mary Lou Retton and didn't see myself. But I was also, you know, in a very low-income community and didn't really have access to those sports. And I don't think you think that you can, right? Like,
right.
If Precisely. You're living in a certain area, you might not, like, you know, we talked about earlier, you might not have access to the ski slopes. You might, I mean, not know what to wear. And there's a lot of cost that's involved here, too. It's
so
not just
many.
Buying the outfit, right? It's actually getting the training and making sure that you have the best trainers, right?
Precisely. There's a cost for every aspect of it. It's the gear. It's the ski lift ticket, right? It's the coaching and getting coaches in places. A lot of people who are Olympic contenders are able to subsidize education in a variety of ways. And all of those things have a tremendous impact on accessibility of the sport.
But there are some good things to look forward to. Like you said, we're higher. This is the most diverse team that we've had, right, as Americans.
Yes,
and so
yes.
There are going to be some exciting moments.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it's wonderful to see. Both Chloe Kim talked about how wonderful it was to win a gold medal in Korea, which is where her parents immigrated from, and feel like that was something that was really monumental. You had Alex Shibutani write this wonderful heartfelt post about how hard him and his sister have worked to be the first ice dance team of Asian descent to win a medal, and saying if someone tells you you can't do something, your success will be limited because of how you look or who you are, keep moving forward. And I just think that this is a time where we can really look to the athletes themselves and seeing the standards that they're setting for what the future could be if we work very hard to get there. And I do have to say that all this discussion about diversity is actually having this very funny effect where people are freaking out about political correctness, and you get articles that bemoans the Olympics for becoming, quote, darker, gayer, different. And so I think that it tells you that there is a real kind of energy here and a conversation that hasn't necessarily existed before, because, like I said, everybody was very content to kind of shrug their shoulders and be like, oh, well, black people don't like cold, so why would there be diversity? And I think one of the things that this time, this moment gives us is the opportunity to really do what we're doing and say, well, let's unpack that. Like, why isn't it more diverse? And we have these wonderful representatives, ambassadors of the sport who are showing you that you compete. We have Aaron Jackson, who just picked up skates and is out there, you know, completely taking names and numbers. And so that is really kind of breaking down a lot of these kind of stereotypes and narrative that we have. And it creates a moment where we can say, hey, no, how can we deepen this? How can we further this? How can we push that 8% right up?
Thank you so much for being with us on The Takeaway today.
Thank you. Anytime.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. All right, back to our top story. Our voicemail is full of you telling us your reactions to the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School last week.
Hi, my name is Kathleen, and I am calling from Venice, Florida. I'm a first grade teacher. We have our code red or safety drills where we get into an area of the classroom that can't be seen from the windows. The blinds are closed. The door is locked. And the lights are off. But honestly, I considered, after hearing the news, of buying a bulletproof blanket so that I could get some command hooks and hang it on the inside of the door when we're in there.
This is Ivan from San Diego. I think the schools need more mental health counselors on campus. Maybe services like wraparound, just to support the students and the families. Most of the services that schools provide with mental health services are putting a Band-Aid on it.
I'm calling from Mendham, New Jersey. I think the only way we're going to get meaningful gun laws in this country is to take the money out of Washington. I think we need serious campaign finance reform. And once we get the money out of Washington, you'll actually see our elected officials go to work for us.
Keep telling us what you think. And thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.